way too high. Laura, where's the DNA? Mike, where's the DNA? Start distributing the tubes, please. This thing's gonna drive me nuts. Hold it down, maybe.
Wanna get down lower? Closer to you?
That's right.
Got everybody? How are you doing, my man? So, Jessica talked to you about the filming and stuff. And I want to see the class. I want to see interactions. I want to see people. I don't want to see so much the screen. I want to, like, a music video, basically. More active it is, the better, okay? Because we'll use this for a big project tonight, okay?
Great.
I'm going to adjust your volume.
Once I get going, okay.
Yeah. Great.
Get going, I'm ready. Get it out. Gloria, cut it. Cut it. Jessica, cut.
Thank you.
So welcome to HC70A. As you can see from the start of this class, this is going to be something different than you've ever been in UCLA or ever will have at UCLA. And as I look around the room, and I know many of you not by face yet, but I will soon, you're going to see that this is going to be a remarkable experience. And this experience is going to be really, in many respects, unlike anything you've had at this university. And so I just want to welcome you all, and I want to plunge in into the subject matter, but actually welcome you to this brand new classroom. And this classroom was built over the last couple of years, and in many respects it's not quite done. But this is a classroom that I will be using for long-distance learning in classes that I've taught in the past, although I've taught them in, where did I teach those? In Knudsen, simultaneously to you guys at UCLA and to people across the Pacific in Japan. And we'll be doing that in this room, a lot of long-distance learning. So let me plunge in and just start and tell you something about what we're going to talk about the entire quarter. We're going to talk about what has become an age in which you live in, which is the age of DNA, the age of the gene, the age of genetic engineering, the age of genomics, that is sequencing genomes, and the age of cloning stem cells and mammalian reproduction. Let me say that over again, because I'm not sure that all of you have really grasped yet from reading in a variety of different places, what that really means and what really the implications are of what I just said. So you live in an era that's very unique. You live in an era in which, when I was your age, many years ago, don't let me bug you here, when I was your age many years ago, the things that are possible now were completely impossible, things that we didn't even dream of, things that we couldn't imagine. And those of you who are English majors, those of you who like to read science fiction, will not find any of the things that I'm going to talk about this quarter over the next 10 weeks in any science fiction book prior to 1970. Completely imaginary, completely out of the realm of possibility. But you live in this age of DNA in which everything becomes possible. And when I say everything becomes possible, I mean that. There is absolutely no biological limitation to anything that anybody in this room can do experimentally. And I want you to grasp that, because that has really profound philosophical, biological, political, sociological implications for us and for everybody across the globe. So we live in an age in which DNA is in the news all the time. You read about people, you know, being factors of person now being tested after they're dead because they were executed for presumably committing some murder. And now they're doing DNA testing to see whether they executed the wrong person. So every day you read about DNA. And we're going to come back to this in a few minutes. But you also live in this era, not only of genes and DNA, where it's pretty commonplace, and all of you have heard about it, and all of you have thought about it, and it's hyped on the news, but you also live in this age called genetic engineering. One of the things that I'm going to point out immediately is that genetic engineering is an ancient technology. What I mean by that is, for those of us who do genetic engineering, including myself, and those of us at UCLA who do this, don't worry about that, Mike, those of us who do this stuff, genetic engineering is older than you guys. Genetic engineering is 30 years old or more. From a biological point of view, from a technological point of view, this technology is older than computers, older than the Macintosh, older than iPods, older than any of that stuff. And so we're really dealing with a mature technology. But a mature technology in which has become so sophisticated that we can really manipulate almost any gene that you could ever imagine. Heck, manipulate genes That's about a 20-year-old technology. How about synthesizing any gene that you want? Synthesizing genes. That's even more ancient. How about synthesizing an entire genome, meaning the entire chromosome of an organism? Now, if you don't think that that's possible, it's already been done. There are synthetic polioviruses walking around in laboratories now that have been synthesized purely from chemicals. Think about what that means from a philosophical or a religious point of view. You have a living organism, a virus, that has been created as a test tube simply from carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen atoms. And it functions. And it divides. And it does what it's supposed to do. And that's the era of genetic engineering that you live in, which is very different than the genetic engineering era in which I started my professorial career in and was at the groundbreaking scene when all of it came about. And so you live in this era of genes and DNA, you live in this era of genetic engineering, but more importantly, you live in this era in which any gene from any organism on the face of this earth can be identified, its structure understood, and what process in that organism the gene controls can be investigated. And more than that, any of those genes can be isolated, any of those genes can be manipulated, any of those genes can be synthesized, any of those genes can be shuffled, any of those genes can be put in combination with any other genes. And you live in this era in which not only do we know the sequence of the human genome, plant genomes, viral genomes, bacterial genomes, fly genomes, mouse genome, dog genome, chicken genome. You live in an era in which we can synthesize all of these things together. You live in this era in which we understand sufficiently the structure of DNA. We understand sufficiently how we can manipulate DNA by genetic engineering. We understand sufficiently how we can determine all of the genes in the genome of a very complex organism, meaning you guys and I. We know what all of our genes are. There's no mystery anymore. We could tell you every single solitary one of your genes in your chromosome. And in fact, in a couple of weeks, you're going to be able to see your own DNA fingerprint right in this class, because we're going to DNA fingerprint every single solitary one of you guys just as you sit at this table. And you'll be able to know what your this little genetic composition is. So we can do all of these things, and we can do more. Because what we can also do is you live in this era of what I'll call mammalian reproduction and cloning. And that is, it's feasible to take a single cell. Of course, we've always been able to do this with plants. No big deal. We've been able to take single cells from plants for 50 years and make a whole plant. You guys probably do that all the time when you do cuttings and stuff like that. But the point here is that you can clone a cat. You can clone a dog, although that was a bit controversial in the news these days. You can clone a horse or a sheep or a frog. And I promise you that it'll be able to clone humans. And if you don't think it'll be done, you're mistaken. It will be done. Because science is never stopped. Never stopped. The progress of science marches on. But the most important message that I want to leave you with in a little brief introduction and interlude before we have a little bit of fun is the fact that, Mike, could you erase that for me, please? Is the fact that we have a synthesis of all of these technologies. And what I mean by that, and this is very profound, we have the synthesis of DNA and genes that we understand the chemical structures of. We have the synthesis of genetic engineering. We have the synthesis of understanding the chemical composition and structure of every single solitary gene in any organism. You name the organism, I'll be able to tell you every gene in that organism and what it does. Within certainly 6 months, if it's a complicated organism, and if it's a simple organism like a virus in a day, and if it's a little bit more complicated organism like a bacteria, well, we could sequence that as an undergraduate research project. In a quarter. This is pretty simple stuff. So you live in this era in which all of this stuff comes together, including the ability to genetically engineer mammals, genetically engineer human beings, and if you think that there's no human beings walking around that are genetically engineered, you're mistaken, because there are human beings that are genetically engineered. Everyone complains, oh, look at plants, they're genetically engineered. What about the human beings walk around that have been genetically engineered? We're going to talk about that. But the point here is that you live in the synthesis of these things, in which we can combine all of these technologies, every single solitary one of these technologies, and be able to, in fact, do anything we want biologically and genetically. So let me just start by asking a couple of you, let's see, Melissa, philosophy major, junior, Borkenhagen, where are you, Melissa? Could you come down here a minute for me? You don't mind. You mind taking a microphone and giving us a little lecture and talking to us a little bit about philosophy and stuff like that? You don't mind, do you? You're blushing a little bit. Have you ever been called down in front of a lecture class in your life? Yeah? Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And let's get Hannah up here, Hannah Kaplan. You here, Hannah? You're a French major. And let's get, who do you want? Just pick someone who's a biology major here. How about Ellen? How about Ellen?
That's good.
Ellen Snavely, bio major. Are you here, Ellen? Or did you decide to opt out? Oh, Ellen's not here. How about, well, you pick it, Melissa. Just go for the list. You go for it. Just pick anyone you want. Any major, any year, any person, any gender.
Hugh.
Go ahead.
Hugh Alexander.
Where are you? Two or two?
Benjamin.
Got to get the last name. Okay, Ben.
Goldenson?
Ben Goldenson. There you are, Ben. Ben is a biology major, am I right? Or presumptive? You a freshman or are you a sophomore? Freshman by year, sophomore by credit. Good. Come on down, three of you. Okay. First thing I want to know, Melissa, philosophically, what's a gene? You got some, yeah, talk into the microphone.
What
do you think? What is a gene? What's your idea of what a gene is? You can talk to the class. You're the professor for now. What do you think a gene is?
I don't really have much to say about
that. Oh, sure.
Philosophically.
Well, what's a gene biologically?
I don't know that either.
Sure you do. You've heard about genes, haven't you?
Of course I have.
Okay, what have you heard about genes?
Scientific.
Tell me what you've heard a little bit about genes. What have you heard? I'm not interested. It's your class that's interested.
I'm sure they all know more than I do.
No,
about this.
Come on, you know a lot. What do you think genes do?
They code the human body or the living animal body.
Show me an example. Do you mind if I touch you? No.
No, I don't.
Yeah, so un-PC, you know. Get a petition for sexual harassment or something. It's a different era.
If you keep the point here is, questions, I
yeah, will. Well, okay, I'm not, you know. The point here is just give me an example on your body of something that a gene might specify.
My eye color.
Okay, what else? So you do know something about genes.
My height.
Okay, what else? You think one gene?
Everything about a single gene?
Yeah, you think there's one gene for your eye color?
No.
You think there'd be one gene or many genes?
Many genes.
What about for your hair? One gene or many genes?
One gene. Or many genes.
What do you think? I don't know. I'm not going to
tell
you. You sure?
I'm going to ask you.
No, I'm not telling you. In this class, I don't answer any questions, as you'll soon find out. Would you like to ask Hannah whether hair color is controlled by one gene or many genes?
Do you know Hannah?
What do you think, Hannah?
Many genes?
What do you think? You guessing or do you know?
I'm guessing. I don't know.
Well, how do you think your hair grows? How does your hair grow? Does it grow? Does it get long? Does it have a color? Does it come out of your scalp or your skin in some way? Do you think that would be one gene that would control that process or many?
The growth of hair?
Or everything. Every part of it.
I think different parts of different genes that express themselves.
So different parts of different genes. So there'd be one gene or many genes?
Many.
And what do you think... from a biological point of view, Ben, genes are doing to make this brown hair of Melissa's?
Different genes do different things. Some would code for...
You're nervous, aren't you?
Little. Some would code for...
How come you're nervous?
I don't know.
What are you nervous about?
Okay. Some genes would code for the color of hair, some for the texture.
More nervous, I know.
Some would code for how fast the hair divides.
No reason to be nervous.
Okay.
So some genes what?
Code for the color of the hair.
The
texture, thickness.
Texture, almost everything, right?
Yeah.
So Melissa, have you ever seen a gene?
No.
Okay, what would you be your hypothesis for what a gene would look like?
Do you want me to draw it?
What would you think your hypothesis for what a gene would look like? What would it be, you think? Is it made up of something? Is it just some philosophical entity, or is it
a
real
not
thing?
A philosophical entity.
It's not.
Is
it a real
that
thing?
I know.
Is it a real thing?
Yes, I
is
think
something
it's a real
you
thing.
Believe in? Or
no.
Is it something you can grab onto?
Yes, I think
is
it's
something,
something
you
can grab
onto.
Is it
something you have an opinion about, or is it something that does something real?
I think that it's something
an opinion poll about?
I think it exists outside of thought.
Okay, so a gene exists outside of thought. How do you know that a gene exists?
I don't.
How would you go
I
about showing
it? I trust biologists like you.
No. You absolutely don't want to do that. It's the worst thing. Anything that I say, you want to be against. That's your job, to be against things, not for things. So how would you, Hannah, show that a gene existed? So we have a hypothesis that a gene is some substance, right? Some kind of substance, correct?
Right.
You want to call someone down here to help you as well? You can get more people down here.
Any bio majors?
No, I can't do that. We don't want bio majors. I already made it easy for you here. See the reds and the blues and stuff? Yeah,
okay.
Well, that's a good one. Anton.
Anton?
Physics major. Where are you?
Right here.
Let's come on down here, Anton. You had a big smile on your face a few seconds ago. I like physics majors. They're some of my favorite students.
How come?
Because they're smart kids sometimes. In any case, how would you show that a gene exists? How do you show that a gene exists? What's your hypothesis? Gene has a substance. That's our hypothesis on the floor. How would you show that it existed or not?
Well, I would identify certain properties that the substance has.
Oh, excellent.
And then
would you like to outline those on the board, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5?
I don't know.
Well, take the blue pen and just go, what are the properties of those of that substance? Take a just pick up the pen. There's one right there.
That's hard
the
to
blue
say.
Blue pen. One thing you'll see is we have fun in this class. This is the way this class operates. The whole thing. Go ahead. What are the properties of that substance? What do you think? We have. Melissa, let's give a hand. You take a red pen. What are some of the properties?
No.
What are the properties?
It's really small.
Okay, well, it's really small. Okay, what else? You think you could see it with your own eye?
No.
Ah, okay. Really small, can't see with your own eye. What are some of the other properties of this substance? Hannah? Should you be able to see it at all?
Yeah, you can see it under a microscope.
Okay, see it under a microscope. So it's small, you could see it under a microscope. So you have to have some tool for visualizing this gene, correct? If you can't visualize, you don't know that it exists. How do you prove philosophically that something exists?
Well, that, I don't think that a gene has to be proven philosophically.
Good. I like that. Okay, so it's small and you have to have something to show, you have to have some tool, like a microscope. Do you need to have a microscope? Could you have some other tool to show that the gene exists?
Probably.
What do you think? If it's a substance, what could you do with that substance? Could you isolate that substance? You think? Yes or no? What do you think?
Should be possible.
Okay, so you should be able, the third property is isolated, right? And is the gene, why don't you say, you should be able to see it under magnification, should be able to isolate it. And what about, Ben, isolating the gene? Is it a chemical of some kind?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so you should be able to isolate it because it's a chemical of some kind, theoretically, right? So why don't you write that down? You should be able to isolate it because it's a chemical. So it's small. You should be able to see it in some way. You should be able to isolate it in some way. And it's tangible, correct? Melissa? It's tangible, right?
Yes.
You get your hands on it.
Yes.
I think you could get your hands on it.
You can get your...
Get something on it, right?
Yes.
Now, what if I told you that you'd be able to get your hands on all of your genes right now? Would you believe me?
No.
You wouldn't believe me?
No.
How many would believe me if I told you you'd get your hands on all of your genes right in this room? How many would say that that's possible? That you could have in your hand every gene in your chromosome? Come on, don't be shy. How many would say no?
I guess I was wrong.
No, well, you're not. Come on, too insecure here. Your opinion is just good. How many would say no? Come on, don't be shy. Raise your hand. So one, two. Some of you haven't voted yet. How many says you could get a hold of your genes in your hand and feel exactly what it feels like in this room? Yes? Raise them high. You know, it's no hanging chads here. Raise them high. Who says no? Okay, so the yeses have it. So we have a hypothesis that the gene is made up of some substance. Why don't you guys gather in here? Gather in here. We have a hypothesis that the genes are made up of some substance. We have a prediction that if it's made up of some substance, you should be able to see that substance in some way, correct? Either in a microscope or in your hand. So we have a hypothesis, we have a prediction. Now, in order to satisfy that prediction, what do we have to do, physicists? If we have to satisfy those predictions, what do we have to do?
To test a substance.
So you have to do an experiment, right? Okay, well, we're going to do an experiment right in this class. How many of you have these little blue test tubes right in front of you? How many test tubes do you have? How many don't have those little blue test tubes? If you don't, let's get them two little blue test tubes now. So everyone, hold up your test tubes. High. Okay? There's two of them. So what's your name?
Josh.
Is the substance in those tubes the same amount or different amounts? And the blue cap should be on the top. Do you have equal amounts or different amounts?
More D than an A.
Where are your blue tubes? Why don't you go grab them and bring them down? Okay? There's more of what?
There's more of the liquid B than of A.
Okay, there's more of liquid B than liquid A. So let's just go over this right now, and I want you to listen carefully to this because it's subtle, but what we're doing is an experiment. We have a hypothesis on the floor. Melissa's hypothesis is that the gene is something that's tangible. Is that your hypothesis? Something, the gene is a substance of some kind.
It's a substance.
The DNA is a substance of some kind. We have Anton's predictions that it's a substance, you should be able to see it. With something, a microscope, with your eye, get it in your hand, should be able to feel it. It's just not some invisible entity wandering around in the solar system someplace. And if we have a hypothesis and if we have predictions, we should be able to test those predictions by carrying out an experiment. We can never completely prove the hypothesis, but we can falsify it because if it turned out not to be a substance, you know, whatever. But the point here is that we can go through a series of experiments in order to predict that we have a substance. And some of you said that you couldn't get this substance in your hands, and most of you said that you could. Who said that you could? What's your name?
Nick Hill?
How do you spell that?
N-I-K-H-I-L.
Okay, Nick Hill. You got these genes in your hand, what would it feel like? What would it feel like? Would it be hot?
No.
Would it be slimy?
Yeah.
Be slimy. Why would it be slimy? Why would it be slimy? Is that like the ooze from, you know, the primeval, you know, why would it be slimy?
I get the feeling that it would be with all of
you get the feeling. Why? Think it'd be slippery, like, what do you think it would look like if you had it in your hand?
Like mucus.
Like mucus? How do you know it would be like mucus? How do you know it would be like mucus? Good hypothesis here.
Yeah, I mean, I remember doing a...
I don't want to know what you remember. I want to know what you think it is. If you remember, then that's cheating. No, we don't want you to cheat. How many people think it would look like mucus? How many people have seen genes? We've got one who has. How many people have never seen genes? Okay. So I want you guys to... Come on, Melissa. I want you to take this little jar. I want you to hold it. Did you ever do anything other than outside of biology class? In high school, which must have been a few years ago. And I want Hannah to help, and I want all of you to take the caps off of your tubes. No, we'll do that afterwards. Just leave the caps on. Now I want Anton to take the tops off of these tubes, these flasks. Okay, and I want Ben to give me your tubes, and I want Ben to hold that magic rod, and I want Hannah to pour slowly down this flask. Why don't you move all up so everyone can see? Pour slowly down this flask, and you can put it on this bench if you want. Down the side, I want you to pour slowly that liquid. What does it smell like, that liquid?
Alcohol.
Ah, it smells like alcohol. What does this stuff smell like?
Vinegar.
What does it smell like? Come on.
I smelled it. It smells like vinegar.
God, it smells like vinegar. Why does it smell like vinegar? You hate the smell. Does it smell like vinegar?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be horrible that your jeans smelled like vinegar? I thought it was going to smell like mucus or something like that. I thought it was going to smell, well, it could smell like anything. You know, it's a biological substance, and you guys smell biological substances every day, so you never know what the genes are going to smell like. But the point here is that take that slowly down the side, like you're cooking something. What are you seeing, Melissa? Describe it. It's an observation. Speak up. Get the microphone. What do you see? What do you see?
It's becoming
slowly
translucent.
Becoming translucent, so opaque kind of, is it?
Yes.
So the color change?
Yes.
Okay, hold it, Hannah. Color changed. See anything else?
And
color changed.
It
what do you see in there?
Like there are particles,
particles
moving around inside.
Particles moving around
inside. That you
inside.
Couldn't see before.
Okay, who's got the magic rod? Want to grab it? What do you got? Stick it down in there. If it doesn't work, be the first time in 20 years. Roll it around. What's happening? Pull it out. Got it? What's it look like? What's it look like? Tell me what that looks like, Dan. I mean, Ben, what's it look like?
The white substance.
What's it look like?
Glue.
Looks like glue. What else does it look like?
Semen.
Who said that? Do you ever see semen? You have? When? Tell me when you've seen semen. Seriously. No, really, verify that. When have you ever seen it? Mike, next time you need about 100 times more DNA than you put in here. I don't know how many grams you put in there. It was about a tenth of a milligram, but that's okay. They may not see anything in their tubes. We'll see. When did you see the semen? Huh? Yesterday? That's pretty good. think I've seen it for about 20 years. In any case, so what else does it look like? Ben, touch it. Put in your, get your hands on that stuff. What does it feel like?
A little slippery.
A little slippery. Does it look like mucus?
It's a little more solid, not as runny as mucus.
Solid. Okay, now all of you pick up your tubes and pour slowly the large volume into the small volume. Gloria, we have some garbage bags to drop all this stuff off into. What I want you to do is to pour and then watch. Anything happening? Something happening? What do you guys see? What's your name?
Jennifer.
Jennifer?
Yes.
What do you see? Hold it up to your eye.
It's like little strands.
What do you guys see? Hold it up.
Like
take one of them over there and show it right to that cameraman and put it right in there. So he can hone right in on this for part of your class project at the end of 10 weeks. So why don't you just go and stick it right in the camera so you can get some of that stuff. What does it look like? Jennifer, what's it look like? What's it look like?
Little strands of cotton.
Little strands of cotton. Okay. Looks like little strands of cotton, right?
Yes.
What's your name?
Regina.
Regina, what does yours look like?
It looks a little bit like the, I'm not sure what they're called, but like the jellyfish. They're,
looks like
they're
a jellyfish or something.
Tentacles or something.
Okay. What is your name?
Daisy.
Daisy. I like Daisy. What does it look like?
I think it looks like that really gross white part of the egg when you crack
looks
it.
Looks like the right part of the egg that you crack it. Okay. Where's your stuff?
I didn't get any.
Didn't get any? Where's the tubes here, man? Let's get with the program. What's yours look like?
Like mucus.
Like mucus?
I would say.
Submerged
underwater.
A lot of mucus or a little mucus? A
little bit. But
okay.
Then it's going to have to ring around it.
Ring around. What's yours look like?
Pretty much the same as everyone else's.
Okay, now I want you to take this little rod and I want you to just pick it out and start feeling it. Guys can sit down if you want. We'll come back to you in a few minutes.
Sure.
Okay. I want you to put it and start feeling it. Feel it. Get your hands on that stuff. Mush it around. Where's Sean Peterson?
Oh, that's Shauna.
Shauna, I admit. What do you think of that stuff? Grab this microphone. We have a few more, but I don't know where they are. Yeah, we got to get you because that's the only way we can get you on tape.
Okay. It feels sort of like cotton or some kind of synthetic fiber maybe in your hand. It does feel like fiber, though.
It dries out,
doesn't
it?
I kind of lost it. It's so small, but it's
what would you think if I said you could dry it out and leave it there for 100 years and you could then put it in water and it would reconstitute itself?
That'd be really awesome.
What does that say about immortality? Think a gene might be immortal?
It's possible, if that's true.
Think a gene might be immortal?
I think that that probably is true.
You think it is?
I think that there's probably something that you could do.
Where did your genes come from?
My parents.
Where did those genes come from?
Their parents.
And where did their genes come from?
All over the world.
And where did their genes come from? Was there ever a beginning or an end?
That's a philosophical question. Maybe
is there
Hannah.
Ever a beginning or an end to your genes?
Yes.
Oh, there's an end? When?
Well, not an end. Maybe a beginning, though.
There's a beginning, but is there ever an end to your genes?
I hope not.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think so. I don't think so. So what you have in your hand are your own genes. What you have in your hand are all the genes in your chromosomes. What you have in your hand is every single solitary gene that controls every single solitary trait in your entire body. What you have there is the genes that control everything that makes you, you. What you have there is a full set of human genes. Daisy, where did we get those genes from?
What's your hypothesis? I'd like you to get used to talking in the microphone.
Sorry.
Where do you think we got those genes from? Somewhere, right?
Yeah, from inside a cell.
Where do you think those genes... What would be the easiest source of genes that you could get your hands on if you wanted to isolate them and take a look at them?
DNA?
Well, DNA are the genes. Where did we get this stuff so that you could look at it and get it in your hands? Where are the genes in your body?
From any cell.
Okay, from any cell. What cell do you think would be the easiest place to get those genes from?
A hair cell.
A hair cell. You think there'd be a lot of genes in a hair cell?
I don't know.
You ever pulled a hair out?
Yep.
It's one cell. You think you could get a ton of DNA from one cell?
Nope.
What do you think? Yes or no?
Nope.
You guessing or you knowing?
I know.
Okay, you know. So what would be, in order to get all that DNA, you'd have to start pulling out all of your hair, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what would be an excellent source of DNA that we used for this little experiment? Mike, can you take this for me? Thank you. What do you think? Sam Brown, what do you think? Where do you think we'd get this DNA?
Well, it looks like we mixed alcohol and vinegar, maybe?
Right.
Alcohol and vinegar?
What part of the body do you think would be most plentiful in DNA?
Your bloodstream.
Your bloodstream. What if I told you that your red blood cells don't have any nuclei, so therefore all of the blood that you have that's red has absolutely no DNA in it?
That wouldn't be good.
Mm-hmm. So how would you be able to get some DNA? What do you think would be a plentiful supply?
Fat cells.
We're just going to take a knife, you know, we're going to rip. Where do you think would be the best part that would be so rich in DNA? What do you think?
Thigh meat.
What?
Like your side,
yeah,
right here.
We got to be able to get it, you know, you're going to be getting it out of dead bodies or something here? Shauna, what do you think? Saliva. That doesn't have a lot of cells. We're going to be testing your saliva in a few weeks. Daisy, what do you think?
Semen.
Semen. Why do you say semen?
Because they make babies.
Yeah, but that doesn't answer the question.
Well, that's the source of the genes that create...
Why would that be a source of a large amount of DNA? That's the question. We know what semen does. Actually, semen... If semen could make babies, boy, we could get awfully rich.
Because each sperm cell has the DNA within it.
Yeah, so each sperm cell has the DNA in it. And how many sperm cells in an average ejaculation?
3,000.
How many say thousands? How many would say millions? How many would say tens of millions? Let's go to about 10 million. So each sperm cell has, you know, a complement of DNA, and there's 10 million sperm cells. So what you just have in your hand is sperm DNA.
Cool.
So you have the whole complement, has a Y chromosome and an X chromosome, but not two X's. So you have that whole complement right there. So what I'd like you to do is put the caps on your little tubes, and I'd like you to pass them to the end where Gloria and Mike and Jessica are going to put them in these little garbage bags. And then we're going to move on. So, Shauna, what did you think about that experiment?
You ruined my sex life.
I ruined your sex life?
What?
You're too young to have a sex life. What did you guys think of that experiment, Hannah? Come on, smile for me, will you? What did you think of that experiment? What? Did you ever do an experiment in class before?
Yeah.
When? In high school. Yeah, but not in college. You don't do any experiments in your French classes?
No.
Okay, well, we're going to do a lot of experiments in this class. So the point here is that you can see your genes, that the genes are tangible, you can get your hands on those genes, and you can do some stuff with those genes. And the genes, obviously, are made of this substance called DNA. Now let me tell you about some really remarkable stuff. And we're going to come back to you in a few minutes in terms of this interactive approach. Let me pull the screen down, and you're going to bear with me because this is the first time I have ever taught in this classroom, and I must say I'm not doing too badly, am I, Jessica? Okay. So there's that, and there's that. Now we got where we want. Okay, so we said we live in this era of DNA, and you just touched this DNA, and it's a real substance. And you just went through an experiment to show that you could see DNA and that you could feel DNA and that DNA exists and DNA is something real. And you're going to learn quite a bit about the fact of how people were able to demonstrate that DNA was in fact the genetic material. But the point here is that DNA, much like genetic engineering, two presses, Brandon, or one, there we go, DNA, you have a handout that has all of this stuff. DNA is something which is very real. It's something which you've just felt and touched and talked about and hypothesized about. But the fact of the matter is that this substance, DNA, and this genetic engineering thing, as you'll see, is right in your home. So any of you can send off any of your DNA and get it tested for any number of genes that you could ever want. And that means that there's home DNA testing kits and things that you can use. So it's not just that DNA is this mysterious thing that I use in my laboratory, of which, you know, only weird scientists, you know, these mad scientists use, but it's something that is part of your daily life, and it's something which you can use, and it's something which is viable, and something which can be very, very, very important and a predictor of a variety of different things. So this stuff is real. And this thing called DNA and this thing called genetic engineering is something that all of you talk about in some way, shape, or form or use in some way, shape, or form in your life. And as I said, you can take a drop of blood. You can test the newborn. You can take a family, maybe Shauna's family, maybe Daisy's family. You can take a family and you can look at this thing called a pedigree. The pedigree, which you'll learn an awful lot about in this class, and this particular pedigree shows the black means there's a genetic disease. The white means that there's no genetic disease. The round is a female, the square is a male. And what this shows is the transmission of a genetic disease in two families, and it also shows that two individuals from those unrelated families are coming together and having children, and DNA testing can be used to determine whether or not, let's say, the parents or any members of the family have the defective disease gene, or whether or not the children will have it, or whether the child that is developing has the particular disease gene that's in question. And DNA testing, and you won't really know what this is yet, but you will soon, DNA testing, and this is called a fingerprint, DNA testing can be used as a predictor. And I'm not going to get any technical than that today, but the point here is that you can see that this individual has this genetic trait, and the DNA pattern for that individual is very different from this individual, which does not have that genetic disease. And so one can do DNA testing with these different patterns, and technically it's not important to get into it, because you guys are going to be experts at this in a couple of weeks, but it's important to be able to know that this stuff does affect your life. And DNA, genetic engineering, genomics, sequencing is in your daily life. And furthermore, it's important to know that in fact, all of you have been genetically tested. Every single person in this room has been tested genetically. How many people knew that? How many of you didn't know that? Every single one of you have been tested at birth. How many of you think that that's mandatory or not mandatory? Is it mandatory or not mandatory? How many of you think it's volunteer? It's voluntary. How many of you think it's absolutely not voluntary, that it's mandatory at birth, that every child born in the state of California be tested either by DNA or conventionally for a number of diseases, No ifs, ands, or buts. How many of you say that actually takes place? Regardless of whether the parents want it to happen or not, how many say no? Well, the fact of the matter is all of you have been genetically tested when you were born. And your parents had absolutely no say in it. Because it's a state statute that all newborn children in the state of California must be genetically tested for a suite of a number of diseases. Now, we'll get into later what those diseases are. We'll get into later what issues in the Constitution, both the state and the federal, allow the government to be able to do something like this. We'll get into those kinds of issues. But the point here is that genetic testing is something which is a part of your lives. It's something that you've all gone through. It's something that occurs. What do you think about that? Shauna, I'm going to call back on you again. Not that I'm going to call on others, but you're a political science major. What do you think? Do you have the microphone? What do you think about mandatory genetic testing, and under what auspices of the Constitution do you think that that's possible?
I don't think I would necessarily agree with that based on my interpretation of the Constitution, but I can see the way our society has been going.
You ever heard the
going.
Preamble to promote the general welfare?
And that's the kind of society we've been going towards.
No, I didn't ask you about the society we're going towards. What do you think about mandatory genetic testing? Be too
as
big of a class to talk
of
all the problems of society.
Yeah.
What do you think about mandatory genetic testing? Of certain traits, not everything, but certain traits. How do you think that's permissible?
I think that it does promote the general welfare. I think that that definitely would be something that it does. However, on the other hand, I think that it also should be something that's voluntary, either on behalf of the individual or of his parents, his or her parents.
And what do you think about that, Sam Brown, in response to what Shauna said?
I guess I sort of agree. It doesn't seem like it should be mandatory, though. It seems like maybe it's an invasion of privacy, or it could violate, like, freedom of religion or something like that. And it also seems like a dangerous thing, because it's like a Pandora's box if the government has something on us, like what we are or what we're predisposed to. Seems sort of strange and goes against.
Well, maybe in some circumstances it could be mandatory, in other circumstances it might be voluntary. Maybe there's some gray area here where you'd say yes on some things and no on others.
Yeah, and you probably have to qualify what you mean by.
So what if there was a disease called phenylketonuria, and what if that disease, which is pretty prevalent in human populations, causes absolutely severe mental retardation? However, if you catch this disease at birth, and you change the diet of the newborn baby, they'll be absolutely healthy and never have a problem for the rest of their lives. Would you think that there should be mandatory genetic testing for phenylketonuria at birth by a simple blood test to show whether the individual is a phenylketonuriac or not?
Well, I think that would depend on whether or not you're going to require response to it.
What do you think?
Well, I don't think someone should be forced to fix their kid if they think it's going to be what we call retarded. I mean, I don't think anyone has an obligation to.
So you think it's okay then for a parent to give birth to a child knowing that they could cure the child of any disease by simply changing the diet and they'd be perfectly healthy, but they would withdraw that change and they'd be very severely mentally retarded for the rest of their life. You think that that's okay?
I think that's a religious philosophical question.
You think that that's okay? Would you do something like that?
I don't know. I'd probably have to read a lot about it and think about it, but, I mean, we all have abnormalities. I don't know if we can necessarily assume that living a normal life and going to UCLA and sitting in this class is somehow more worthwhile than what would have happened if we got, I don't know.
Did you ever take care of a mentally retarded child?
Not as a parent, no.
As a parent?
No.
Do you think it would be challenging and difficult?
Probably.
Do you think that mentally retarded child would have the same opportunity in life as someone such as yourself?
To come to this class?
Well,
maybe not,
general,
but...
in general.
Do
you think that that...
Opportunity for happiness? Opportunity for... What do you mean? Opportunity for love, family?
Do you think that mentally retarded child would have the same opportunity for as full a life as you can, going through to, let's say, age 80 or 90? Do you think it might be possible that there might be all kinds of other medical complications like heart problems, kidney problems, liver problems, physiological problems?
I mean, if we're talking about living a long, long life, linearly or quantitatively, I guess. Yeah, they.
You think they would?
No, I'm saying that you could, if they're going
to
live.
So if you were the parent that thought that you could have this mentally retarded child, where you could have prevented it, we're not talking about some spontaneous situation. You could have prevented it. Who pays for the health care for that child for their entire life? Should society pay?
I mean, if you think society should pay for health care for everybody, I mean, that's the question.
Should society pay for your child that you decided to bring into the world and have a very severe health problem for the next 80 years?
I mean, if society should pay for my, medical care, then I guess it should for them too,
So does society pay for your medical care now, or do you?
I hope it does a little bit.
Does your parents pay for? I don't think society pays for your health care. Who pays for it? I'll bet you your parents do or someone does.
Yeah. In Europe, I think they pay for it.
Well, we're not living in Europe right now, right? We're living in Los Angeles, California, correct? So what do you think about that, Samantha, the math major? Where are you? What do you think about what we just heard? Going off on a little bit of tangent, but these are the kind of issues that we're going to be tackling.
About who pays for the health care?
Well, what do you think about the whole scenario? We have mandatory testing for certain genetic diseases, of which, if you catch them at birth, the child can be completely normal without any defect.
I think there's nothing wrong with that.
What do you think about voluntary testing in that case, where many of those would be missed and many of those children might be very severely mentally retarded or worse?
Voluntary as opposed to mandatory?
Mm-hmm.
I think...
We put you on the spot in this class.
I think mandatory could still be the better option because it would require a lot of education for people to know whether to volunteer for that or not.
Right.
And I think that for the child would appreciate it once they became an adult that they had been tested and had a,
what do you think about a scenario in which this situation with the phenylketonuriate was not mandatory, was voluntary, as we just heard? What do you think about the fact that perhaps you, and I hope you don't, but let's say you or someone else decides not to test their child and they have a very severe mental retardation condition, which isn't simply, mental deficiency, but it's very serious, cognitive level of maybe 2 years old for the rest of their lives with all kinds of other problems. And what do you think if that child comes into being and that child, let's say, grows a little older and that child has some advocates and that child decides to sue you for wrongful life because you knew that you could test that child and you knew that you could prevent that child from having what would be a not-so-healthy life and a not-so-full life. And I know that we can argue about all the philosophical things about what's normal or what's not normal. How many in this room would switch places with someone that has a cognitive level of 2 years old? And how many in this room would agree that perhaps that wouldn't be the fullest and happiest life that someone such as us have? How many would agree? I certainly would, and I wouldn't debate that issue. Not saying that they can't have a life which would be something the best that they could possibly have, but it's not going to be like my life, I can assure you of that. What would you do if they sued you for wrongful life? In tort liability. Didn't know we were going to talk about the law and tort liability in this class, but we're going to. Wrongful life! Mother, you made me mentally retarded by withdrawing that genetic test.
I think
you didn't have to do that.
I think the mother would be responsible for that. I don't know what the child would sue for.
And I would rather have been dead and not born.
It was an issue of being not being born or being born with a mental disability.
Well, you can't say
that's
whether
different.
They be born or not, because you don't know. It's the situation at hand, correct? You don't know. It's withholding the genetic test, of course, but this person's miserable. So they say, I would rather not even be living, because they don't know what it's like to be, quote, normal, which there's no state of normality, but you know what I mean.
What was the question in there? I'm sorry.
What would you think about if you were sued?
Well, I wouldn't enjoy being sued, but I wouldn't have withheld the test in the first place.
Pardon?
I wouldn't have withheld the test
well,
in the first place.
Well, let's say that you did.
Then I would be responsible for the child's quality of life.
Okay, let's pass this to a philosophy major. Let's say you're the judge, Melissa. And can we get these kids on film, please? Let's say that you're the philosophy major, but you're a judge. How would you respond to this wrongful life suit?
I don't think there are grounds for that. I don't think that it's appropriate. Or else a child...
What would you say as
or
a
else
judge?
A child
no,
could
judge doesn't say, I don't think it's appropriate.
I don't think that it says... In, if
judge
that
won't
true,
say, I.
If that... If there were grounds on which a parent could be held responsible for withholding that test,
mm-hmm.
then a child could sue for many, many, many other things
mm-hmm.
that happen
such as?
Throughout their life.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
Well, if you have a god-awful parent who is an alcoholic.
It's all relative,
and
isn't it?
It's all completely relative.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to, I don't know, if you have a
so how would you rule on this case? Let's find
I would say,
specific.
I would say, I don't know enough about the Constitution to rule on this, but I would think that it would be absolutely
judge,
ridiculous to hold the parent responsible.
You'd say it's absolutely ridiculous to hold the parent responsible.
Yes.
How many would agree with that judge's ruling?
Morally, they're responsible.
How many
but as
would
a judge,
disagree with that ruling? Come on, let's get some hands way up, no shy. How many would agree and how many disagree? Okay, we have kind of a split class here. It'll be interesting. Where are those surveys that we had? Can you pass them down if you're done with them?
Mine's not.
Great. So it's going to be interesting to see. So what is the law on this? What is the law? We're getting ahead of the game a little bit. What is the law? The law says that to promote the general welfare, which means the health and happiness of individuals that are born, if and only if you can cure someone of a very serious genetic defect by treating them at birth, you can have mandatory genetic testing. And the only grounds for opting out varies from state to state is on serious religious grounds. Okay? You can object under religious grounds. That gets into another realm in terms of child welfare and all kinds of other things, but to promote the welfare, you do have mandatory testing. We're going to talk a lot about this. What does the law say on wrongful life suits? To get ahead of the game. There have been many, many, many wrongful life suits for failing to genetically test children who did have genetic diseases and did sue their parents. And what do the courts say on that? The courts come down philosophically on that. Courts have said that whether or not the state of being of an unborn child is better than a born child can't be debated because we don't know what the state of non-life is. Therefore, not knowing the state of non-life, we can't rule on this issue except to say that in general, children are not allowed to sue their parents for wrongful life. However, that was in the legislature's hand. And most legislatures in the United States and the states have passed laws saying children can't sue their parents for wrongful life under these circumstances. The point here is that all of these technologies that I'm alluding to, genetic testing, DNA, all of these things impinge not only on biology, but as you can see, philosophy, legal issues, moral issues, all kinds of issues and things that we will be talking about. So let's move a little bit away from the age of DNA, but let's move into the nexus of the age of DNA, which is the age of genetic engineering. And that age of genetic engineering has also entered your home, because what you can see here is that these are these glowfish, and these glowfish can be bought in a pet store, not in the state of California. They're banned from being sold in the state of California for a variety of reasons, but in many other states you can pay $25 and you can get a fish just like this, which glows as much as you want it to glow. And how do you make that fish glow? Well, you take a gene from these jellyfish. Take a gene from the jellyfish. Take a gene from the jellyfish. And there it is. Ah, disappeared. What am I doing wrong, Brenda? Got it. Take a gene from the jellyfish, and these jellyfish glow green. It's called the green fluorescent protein gene, GFP. And that gene can be isolated using genetic engineering technology. And that gene, as I said, can be used to be able to manipulate in any way you want and in any shape you want into any organism. So you ready for a real ride here? Well, here's how it happens. Notice that we have the egg of a fish. Notice that there's a needle that is going towards that egg. And that needle has the jellyfish gene in it, but it's being squeezed into the egg of a normal, in this case, zebrafish, the glowfish, as you can see. So there is a jellyfish gene, and we'll all agree that the jellyfish is a lower form of animal than a normal vertebrate fish that you eat. And we take that gene and we put it inside the egg of this fish, which doesn't have this gene, never seen this gene, doesn't glow, doesn't have this protein, whatever. But now that gene from the jellyfish is in that fish. And notice now when that fish develops, as you can see, we start developing a fish that glows green. I can assure you that these fish never glowed green before. And so we've now genetically engineered this fish with the jellyfish gene in order to glow green. And you can get glow that's red, you can get glow that's green, you can get glow that's all kinds of different colors, but the point here is that we've taken a gene from one organism that doesn't mate with another organism, and we've now combined their genetic information. That's genetic engineering. Taking a gene from one organism, we've stuck it in another organism, but more than that, we've got it to work. We've got it to work in a very, very, very elegant way. Now, if you think that that's something that's new, I got a clue for you. That's 30-year-old technology. To be able to do that, to be able to take that gene from the jellyfish and stick it in another fish, is pretty, pretty, pretty old technology. But now we can do it, there's the glowfish, but we can do it in other kinds of organisms. Look at that. That's a fruit fly. Notice that fruit fly has that green glow as well. Put a little light on that fruit fly and all of a sudden it starts glowing. Does a jellyfish, Anton, gene normally exist in a fruit fly?
It does not.
And so now you've seen the fruit fly with that jellyfish gene working. Do you agree? Pretty amazing, huh? You think that's surprising? You think that's surprising or not?
It's very surprising.
It's very surprising, isn't it? Very surprising. We're going to come back to this in a second. Well, it's a fruit fly. Who cares about fruit flies? You know, it's a fish. Who cares about fish? You know, they're just, okay, but what about in a mouse? Now we got the jellyfish gene in a mouse. Hey, look at that. Not just everywhere in the mouse. It's in the head of the mouse, in the ears of the mouse. Now we just haven't engineered this thing to be everywhere in this mouse. We've targeted. We only want the ears to be green. We only want the mouth to be green. That's genetic engineering. Not just sticking a gene in and getting it to be active everywhere, the organism. We're going to target exactly where it's going. And there it is. How about glow mice? Notice that the tail is green, the feet are green, notice that the ears are green, a little bit of the mouth is green. Pretty neat stuff. That's genetic engineering. We get the gene from the jellyfish, we take the gene, and we stick it in the eggs, in this case of the mouse, and we get that gene to be taken up by the chromosomes of the mouse. That gene's taken up by the chromosomes of the mouse, It's been present in all the cells of the mouse when it's born, and now we've engineered this gene not simply to be active in all the cells of the mouse, we've engineered it to be active in specific parts of the mouse. You're tired. You're positive. Am I boring you? You're sure? Would you tell me if I did? Okay, that's what I want to know. What about in a plant? God, we can take the jellyfish gene, now we're not even sticking it in an animal. We're sticking it in a plant. We're taking an animal gene and we're sticking it inside a plant and we're getting that plant to glow green. What do you think about that experiment? What do you think about that experiment? Calling some new people. What about Nick? Nick Smedley. Where are you, Nick? What do you think about that experiment? Grab the microphone so we can get you on tape.
I think.
What do you think, Nick?
I think that's interesting.
What do you think about that experiment?
Well, I'm taking a cue from your note on the page here, but it's interesting specifically because it goes in different organisms.
What do you think that means about genes? What's your hypothesis? What does that tell you about that gene from the jellyfish? It says a lot of different things. What do you think the first thing it might tell you?
My hypothesis in this case then would be that genes are kind of transferable between different types
Excellent.
Of species.
So genes are transferable between species. What else does it tell you about genes? And gene processes?
That genes kind of dictate the way that we can look and
But what
glow.
Does that tell you about taking the gene from the jellyfish and putting it in a plant or a mouse or a fruit fly or whatever? What does that say?
I mean, other than they're transferable?
Yeah. Not just they're transferable. That's the first part of it. What does it really say? Look at that plant. It's green. It's greener than it usually is. What does that say about that process? What does it say about that process, Nick?
I'm not sure I follow where you're
Well,
you.
We can transfer the gene from one organism to another. Does that mean they necessarily work?
Not necessarily.
What does this experiment tell you?
It worked in this case.
It worked in this case.
Yeah.
So what does that say about a gene from an animal being put in a plant?
In some cases, it'll definitely work.
Let's just use this case.
In this case, it works.
And what does that say about the genetic processes in plants and animals?
That in this case, it's transferable.
Transferable or the same genetic processes? If we take a gene from an animal
I'm running in circles,
and put it in a plant, something's got to be recognized here. Not that the gene works by itself, it works in a cell. The cell has all kinds of substances and molecules and stop chewing your gum and all kinds of different things. They're not on the, yeah, great, not on the back of the chair though. In any case, what do you think it says about the processes, the genetic processes in animals and plants from this experiment?
That the plant cells were able to accept the gene from the animal
it
and
does
use
accept it.
It,
but more than that, what does it say? Yeah.
Puts it into action, kind of.
Puts it in action, absolutely. So that says that not only are genes transferable between species, but it says that the genetic processes, and I'm going to extrapolate a little bit, are universal between kingdoms. That's what that experiment says. It says that the genetic processes in an animal aren't that different from the genetic processes in a plant. In fact, what you're going to learn is that the genetic processes in every organism on the face of this earth are exactly the same, except for minor details. So we can not only do this experiment with a bacterial gene or an animal gene or a plant gene, we can take genes from a plant and stick it in a bacteria. We do it all the time. We can take genes from bacteria, stick it in a plant. We can take genes from a plant, stick it in an animal. We can take genes from an animal, stick it in a plant. There's no limitation. What do you think about that?
Makes for good science fiction.
Not science fiction, though. What do you think about that?
Makes for good science nonfiction.
Well, what do you think about that in terms of helping cure disease? How about taking a human gene called insulin and putting it in bacteria and making insulin as a drug and helping treat diabetics? That's taking a gene from an animal, a human being, putting it in a bacterial cell, using the bacterial cell as a factory to make tons of that gene, and that gene is then active in the bacterial cell. It makes tons of insulin, and that insulin is then used to treat diabetics. Or how about taking the human gene for trypsin tissue plasminogen activator, which dissolves blood clots, and taking that human gene and putting it in a bacterial cell and making TPA, which is used to treat people with heart attacks, dissolve clots and stuff like that. Taking a human gene, putting it in a bacteria, and using that bacteria as a factory. Or what about taking a human gene for an antiviral protein like interferon and putting it in, let's say, fungal cells, and getting those fungal cells to make that antiviral protein and using that to treat hepatitis A and hepatitis B and hepatitis C, which are viral diseases. We've now taken a gene from humans, we put it in a bacteria, we put it in a fungus, and we've been able to make medicinal proteins. What do you think about that? It's not science fiction. What do you think about it? In fact, it's 30 years old, that technology. What do you think about that?
I guess shows that the state of
pharmaceuticals should be done, not should be done. Are you comfortable with that?
I'm a little uncomfortable with that just because it's change, and I guess change makes people uncomfortable.
Just because
I'm a little uncomfortable because I can see that, I don't know, I like the Pandora's box metaphor, because you can see, maybe, I've been reading too much science fiction or something, but in the future, you feel like there's so many weird directions that could go and that we're not used to or comfortable with. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your great-grandparents ever imagined someone would walk on the moon?
They may have imagined it, but...
Do you think your great-great-great-great-grandparents ever imagined that there'd be lights from light bulbs that you screw into the wall? And did you ever think that they imagined that there'd be a computer that you could get on and be connected to people all over the world?
No, probably not.
Would have been the substance of science fiction then, too.
Right.
So, would you be comfortable with a technology that's 30 years old?
Would I personally be comfortable?
Yeah. Rather than something that sprung at you today.
I mean, I'd have to get used to it before I was comfortable with it, I guess.
How many genetic engineering experiments do you think have been carried out in the last 30 years? What's your name?
Jessica.
How are you? Good. You want to take the microphone? Sure you do. Go on, Jessica. How many genetic engineering experiments do you think have been carried out in the last 30 years?
More than 100.
More than 100. How many would say more than 100? How many would say more than 1,000? Now, we're talking about genetic engineering experiments either in basic laboratories or in companies or whatever. How many would say more than 1,000,000? How many would say less than 1,000,000? How many would say more than 10 million? Well, probably more than 10 million or more, I would say, over the last 30 years. Maybe close to 100 million in terms of genetic engineering experiments that have been carried out in laboratories all over the world. How many of you think that genetic engineering experiments are carried out no more than 300 feet from this classroom? How many would say no? Well, yeah, they're carried out in my lab, which is about 100 feet from this classroom. The point is that this is pretty old technology, and I want you to know that. And so, how many genetic engineering, scientifically, how many genetic engineering disasters have you heard about, Ben, in the last year? It was on CNN, there was this genetic engineering disaster. There's now this fruit fly running around that's no longer the size of a fruit fly, but the size of a mouse.
Only heard of a few.
You've heard of a few? Can you give me an example? Can you give me an example?
Yeah. One I remember most clearly is about a gene therapy experiment where the person died.
Yeah. That's a good example. So that was we could consider that to be a genetic engineering disaster. Yes, absolutely. That was one example of an unexpected happening. How many others, let's say, had positive outcomes, perhaps? We'll talk about that later on.
Probably a lot more positive.
What would be the ratio, you think? 1,000,000 to 1, 10,000,000 to 1,
1,000 to 1.
What? there was like 100 million genetic engineering experiments carried out. What do you think? You've heard of one.
Yeah, I'm sure there's others I haven't heard about.
A couple. A few. But in general, you haven't heard about many, right?
No, not many.
But you've heard about all these biotech companies that are making all these wonderful drugs for people that are keeping them alive much longer than they used to, probably, right?
Yeah.
I'll bet you maybe someone you even know are taking these genetically engineered drugs. Like, are there any diabetics in the room that might want to... Anyways, if there were, you'd be taking genetically engineered insulin that's been genetically engineered for 30 years. But the point here is that we learn a lot on this ancient technology in terms of genetic engineering. Why am I hesitating? I bet you some of you might have to pee. Yeah. Let's take a break for a couple of minutes. are you? Okay. Okay. So what I've said so far, a couple of things that probably are very abstract to you now. They seem like they're obvious, but they're not obvious, but you will understand at some point exactly how all of this works, so it becomes not abstract, but it becomes very intuitive. But the point here is that we have these technologies that are very sophisticated, very evolved, and have been the process of, end process of millions and millions of experiments carried out in basic research labs just like my own and many, many, many others. And we learned that DNA is a substance that's universal in all organisms. We learned that genes consist of DNA. We learned that these genes can carry out certain functions in cells and in organisms. We learn that these genes that carry out very specific functions, like making this green fluorescent protein, can be transferred from... Well, backtrack. We learn that genes carry out very specific functions, like making this green fluorescent protein. And we know that because we can take this gene and we can take it from one organism and put it in another organism, and the function of that gene is then established in a new organism. That proves that genes exist. If you can take a piece of DNA, if you can take a piece of DNA, Daisy, much like you've handled with your own hands, and you know that that piece of DNA specifies a particular trait, green fluorescent protein, and you can take that chemical DNA and put it in another organism, and show that you get the green fluorescent protein, whereas there was none before, that shows the existence of a gene, definitively, and shows the existence of a specific gene. And so we know that these genes can function. We understand almost everything there is to know about how these genes function, and we can use genetic engineering to transfer them from one organism to another. But you'll see that, as I showed you, it's not just taking the gene and transferring it from one organism to another, we can start picking the genes apart so that we can start targeting where they're active in different organisms, as I showed you, in the ears of the mouse or in the paws of the mouse. So we can do that, or we can synthesize genes, as I said earlier, or we can do all kinds of things with this technology. That's the first thing I really want you to know. The second thing that I want you to know is that science is carried out, as you carried it out in this class, by a process. And that process is very specific. And in fact, it's almost unlike any process that anyone could carry out. And it is so magical, and it is so elegant, and it is so exciting that when you see things for the first time that no one has ever seen, because you've thought about it, and you've tested it, and you've done the experiments, and you've worked maybe years. Mike, how many hours did you put in the lab last quarter? Just guess.
Thousands.
Well, not thousands, is it?
Hundreds of hours.
How many hours per week?
70 maybe.
And how many courses were you taking at the same time?
Three.
Anyone force you to work in the lab?
Nope.
Did you like doing it?
I did.
Could you quit when you were on the chase?
No.
Rhea, how many hours did you put in the lab each week? These guys are like you guys.
25.
Did you get forced to do it? What did you think about the first time you were able to isolate a gene and clone it? Which you've done. And were you excited doing it with your own hands? And was it very different from the kinds of things that I talked about in class last year?
It was different and faster than theory.
But was it exciting? Very exciting. Well, that's what I want you to take away from what I'm telling you today, that science is a process. And it's an exciting process. And people such as myself and others do it because we love doing it, because not that it's easy, which it isn't, because it's the hardest thing that you could ever imagine, spending years and years and years in working in a lab on a particular thing. But the point is that you see something that no one's ever seen before. It's exciting. So the point here is that there's a process. And you're going to learn the process in this class. And it's not a public opinion poll. It's not what we believe. It's not what we think. It's what we can test, using particular procedures and particular approaches. And so what you did when you went through this process of isolating the DNA, you did an experiment, you did a scientific experiment, you had a process. So you had some hypothesis that derived from some observations that you had about the real world or whatever. And you formulated your hypothesis, which is an explanatory statement to try and explain those observations. And from that hypothesis is derived certain predictions. Each hypothesis has certain predictions. And they're very specific predictions. If the sun comes up every morning, then there should be light every morning. Sun coming up is a hypothesis. The prediction is that there should be light every morning. And you should be able to test that by measuring the light every morning with some photometer or something like that. So we have a hypothesis, we have predictions, but then we have to test them with very specific experiments. Not beliefs, not just things that you think are happening, but very specific experiments that then lead to new observations. The results of your experiments are new observations. And you look at those observations and you try and determine whether those observations that you get from your data are things that you would predict from your original observations that you made the hypothesis from. Now, you can never prove a hypothesis. All you can do is falsify it, meaning say the predictions are either consistent or not consistent with the experimental data. It can never be proved because it's limited by the technology that you use. And hypotheses do change once you can have more and more sophisticated technology or more new observations. And so then the question then is, have the data then been verified? So it's not good enough just to have observations, like what is the gene or what does the gene do, but you have to then have a hypothesis, and then you have predictions from that hypothesis. You then test that hypothesis with specific experiments. And then you have data, which are new observations, and then becomes the test. And all of you have been reading about those tests. In fact, there's a whole page article about this test in the paper today, which is one of the most depressing things that I ever read in my scientific career, because all data has to be verified. That is repeatable. That is not good unless it's repeatable, and mostly repeatable by somebody else. And that's why there's so few cases of scientific fraud, because everything that I do and everyone else is repeated by somebody else in the world, by some other experiment, because I can promise you that science is probably one of the most competitive things that you could ever imagine, because I can guarantee you that anything that we think of these days is probably thought about by 10 other people someplace in the world. So it becomes a little race. And therefore, if you do it, someone else is going to do it, and therefore it's very difficult to falsify data, even though the stem cell, the human cloning example, which has been in the news for the last couple of weeks, which is one of the most extreme examples of scientific fraud that all of us have ever heard about, and many of us who do those kinds of things are completely horrified and depressed about, that is the extreme exception. There's maybe a handful of cases like that over the last 5 decades. But the point here is because all the data has to be published, and then people will pick it up, and they'll reproduce it. And that's the basis of the scientific method. So the things that I want you to take home are what kind of age we live in terms of DNA, gene engineering, et cetera, et cetera. And what I want you to take home is this message today of that there's a scientific process. And that scientific process is going to govern this class very, very strongly in terms of how we approach things, because one of the most exciting things that I love doing as a professor, as a teacher, as a mentor, teaching people about this process, because it's exciting and it's exhilarating and it's fun and it's very different. And furthermore, you're going to learn about this process because this process affects all the things that you do. Gloria, has this process affected your thinking outside of the sciences?
Yes, absolutely.
Does this process affect your thinking in the humanities and all the papers that you write in the English department and literature and all this other stuff?
Yes.
Could you ever have imagined how it would have affected that before you knew what it was about?
No.
Exactly. So the point here is that this process will affect, and I didn't prompt her on this, by the way, it does affect your thinking because it's a different way to think. And so what you need to do in this class, and I'm not going to tell you very much about this class because I never do that. You'll find out. It's like taking you and throwing you into the pool and letting you swim. No lessons here, as you'll see. That's what's so much fun about it. What you're going to learn in this class is how to think scientifically. I don't even care if you don't remember one fact that I teach you in 10 weeks. But if you can come out of here and think critically and know how to ask a question and know how to formulate a hypothesis and know how to think about things in a critical way so that if someone says, hey, you know, man, I ate this tomato and, God, it really put a glow on my face, that you can say, well, what is your evidence for that? You know, what specific things happened to you? Did they happen to other people as well so that it means really that tomato really has that effect, or was it just a placebo effect only happening on you? If you can think like that, then I'll feel that I've been very successful. However, you're going to be able to think like that and you're going to be able to think about all kinds of other stuff. I can promise you that. So let me just go back a minute if I can and show you some stuff. I don't know whether I'm going forward or backward on this thing. There we go. Yeah. Let me tell you about this class. I don't usually do that, but I'm going to tell you. I don't know what's going on with this computer, so I have no clue because I don't generally use one when I teach, as you can probably tell. Okay. Let me see what's happening here. Let me close this down, and let me open this up. And there we go, and I can't see it because I'm getting blind. That's what happens when you get gray hair, but I don't mind because it provides wisdom, and that doesn't matter because it's going to happen to all of you, and you can't escape it unless we genetically engineer ourselves not to be able to do that. So what about this class, HC70A, Genetic Engineering in Medicine, Agriculture, and the Law? We're going to talk a lot about the law. God, you guys probably never even thought that a biology teacher could ever know anything about the law. But unfortunately, you're wrong, because I was a political science major when I was an undergraduate. So I know a little bit about the law. So I get best of both worlds here. And so what you're going to see is an amalgamation of genetic engineering in medicine, genetic engineering in agriculture, which I do, and genetic engineering in the law, which is a little hobby of mine. So you're going to hear a lot about that, about equally through the quarter. So you're also going to hear a lot about a science, which is very important. We have some terrific people that are going to help you this quarter. We have Gloria Chu as a teaching assistant, who happens to be an English major. And we have Mike Gavino, who will be your other teaching assistant, who used to be a psychology major but now is a molecular cell and developmental biology major. And they're going to be leading your discussion sessions, which start tomorrow in very unique ways. And before I forget, there'll be two articles that you'll pick up on your way out, and I'll put this up on the board, and I want you to get those articles, and I want you to read them. And I'll come back to that in a second. And your discussion tomorrow is going to be very much like this, exactly like this. You'll be called on by name, and we'll be discussing things, and it'll be very, very much Socratic, which we'll get into in a second. So the two articles are the recombinant DNA debate, which we're going to go back 30 years and start at the beginning, and the second article is the manipulation of genes, and that's a very scientific article. For those of you who have not had biology since high school, Some of it's going to be Greek to you. And that's exactly the way I intended it. It's kind of like if I plunged into Hannah's French class. And when I had French in high school, they go, Monsieur Goldberg, French is also spoken, because I couldn't speak it worth a darn. But the point here is that it's sort of like learning a foreign language by being plunged in and only speaking the foreign language as you go. And that's kind of the process that we use in this class. And so don't worry whether you understand it or not. I will promise you. In fact, I will trade a month's salary with all of you. That by the end of the quarter, this article that you read for tomorrow that will seem so complicated and so foreign that you'll say, what am I doing here? Will be so easy and so trivial and so simple that you'll say, I don't understand how I couldn't understand it way back then, 10 weeks from now. Rhea, would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Exactly. So the point is, it's like learning a new language. And so what I'd like you to do is to have an adventure. It's called an adventure and challenge yourself intellectually. It's an adventure in the unknown. It's an adventure of something new, because I know most of you are not tracking on to science. In fact, most of you are North Campus kids, which is what this class is primarily designed for. But the point here is, and who I have been teaching for 20 years, kids like you. And so the point here is, I know what you're getting yourself into, but I also have the benefit of knowing that it'll be a piece of cake for you in about 10 weeks. In fact, it's going to be a real eye-opener. And then you have this little textbook that I'd also like you to read, which I chose because it's very easy reading. And you have chapters 1 through 3, and just read them. Don't worry about what you understand and what you don't understand. Don't worry about memorizing or not memorizing or whatever. We're going to take you through this process, and it's going to be quite easy along the way. But be prepared for a scientific discussion, and be prepared for an ethical discussion. But what you need to do tomorrow is go back 30 years. When you come to discussion tomorrow, you're not in 2006. You're in 1973. Keep that in mind. You're going back in time, and you're reading about the first time someone did a genetic engineering experiment, and I want to know what you think about it from the point of view of 1973, not from the point of view of 2006. And Mike and Laura will take you through that in a very, very clever and elegant way. Some of you will have some names, and I don't know where they are because Jessica has them someplace. But not right now, Jessica. Okay. I'm going to call you out. Where's Jennifer? Raise your hand. Where's Jordan? Where's Alejandra? Not here. Here? Where's Matthew Anderson? There you are. Where's T? T-H-I. Where's Matthias Ramos? So can five of you or four of you raise your hands and we'll add another one? The five of you, because we'll add another one, will have the pleasure of having my company at dinner after class on Thursday, because one of the things that I do in this class is take each and every one of you out for dinner at least once during the quarter so that we can interact in a little bit more informal setting. And when we have guest speakers, we'll both grow, and you'll be able to have dinner with the guest speakers and myself at the faculty center. And so those dinners will generally be in the faculty center, and they'll generally be after class on Thursday. And if you can't make it on Thursday or on the days in which you will be assigned, we will change it because Jessica Luke, Jessica, you stand up. She's administered the class, and frankly, we couldn't have this class without her. And she'll be emailing, or you'll email her, and you'll be able to coordinate all of that stuff. So we have these dinners, and there's Jessica's email, which you will have on the syllabus when you get it on Thursday, jluke@mcdb.ucla.edu. And the point here is that this is a novel chance to have dinner with a professor. And I can guarantee you that it'll probably be the first and last time you'll ever have, tragically, a dinner with a professor at UCLA. I hope that's not the case, but generally it is, isn't it, Mike? Have you had any dinner since then?
Zero.
Gloria, have you had any dinner since then? Rhea, have you had any dinner since then? I don't think so. But the point is you have dinner with me and it's a lot of fun. This is just my chance to get to know you and you get to know me, and we have really some really good discussions. So it's your chance to learn anything there is to know about what a professor does. Okay, let me tell you some more about this class and come back to science, and just very briefly. about what's different about this class and where it came from and what it was all about. Okay. And I generally don't do this, but I decided to do it today. So this is a class that's sponsored by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Howard Hughes, how many of you saw that movie, Howard Hughes? There's a movie, Howard Hughes, this guy who was the richest guy in the world. In order to evade income tax, he put all of his money into a foundation, Hughes Aircraft, and he was a real legend and a pioneer, and that foundation turned into a foundation for medical research. And now it expends more money on medical research than almost any foundation in the world. But the Howard Hughes also has a passion, the Institute, for expanding undergraduate education. And so a couple, 3 years ago, they had what we'll call as a competition in order to pick across the United States 20 professors nationwide. And they made those professors after this competition. I'm not going to tell you about the competition or how it worked or how you got it or any of that stuff. But out of a few hundred people, they picked 20 people. And out of those 20 people, they gave each $1 million. And they said, do anything you want with it, as long as you teach exciting things to undergraduates. And so this is sponsored by the Howard Hughes, because fortunately I was one of the individuals to get $1 million. And a lot of $1 million is spent on your dinners and all kinds of other things and all kinds of equipment to make your education better. But the key was to try and excite undergraduates, mainly non-science undergraduates, about the excitement of science. So we have this three-part program, and I'm only going to tell you this. I've never told my classes for this, but this might actually be the last time I teach this class for a very long period of time. So you have to know why I'm teaching it. And so one is to provide you the foundation in molecular biology and genetic engineering and tell you all about some exciting things in science. The second thing is to teach undergraduates how to teach. And so when you go in discussion tomorrow, you're going to have your peers that will be teaching you, believe it or not. And I think you're going to be incredibly impressed, more so than you could ever imagine, because these two undergraduates, Gloria and Mike, have been hand-picked because they are outstanding teachers and can articulate things in ways in which many professors can't. And so we work very hard to teach them how to teach, because that's another passion of mine, teaching. And then finally, to provide a real-life discovery-oriented research. And so what that means is that many of you who choose so will have the chance next quarter to actually work in my lab and do hands-on experiments, not like these things you have in biology class, but we're talking about original experiments. We're talking about things that no one's ever done before in terms of pushing back the frontiers. Because the idea is not only to teach you about the science, but the idea is to teach you how to do the science and how science is exciting. And we've had many, many non-science majors go through this class. Did you like it, Gloria?
I did, very much.
Did you ever do science before?
No.
Didn't change your major either, did you?
No, I didn't.
Exactly. But the point here is that one has a chance to do original research in genetic engineering as part of this program, and that's what this $1 million pays for. In fact, I built a whole laboratory for undergraduates to do genetic engineering in my lab on this thing. And it's a lot of fun for me, and it's a lot of fun for you, a lot of fun for everybody else, but more about that later. This class is different. It's different for so many reasons. You won't really appreciate how different this is until the end of the quarter. But it's something that I've developed over the last 30 years. Fortunately, the world is catching up with me. But in the old days, before the computers and before the audiovisuals, a lot of what I do is considered to be almost heresy and pretty radical. And now it's pretty mainstream, which is great. But the point here is it's very interactive, as you can see. Please turn off your cell phones. Can't be anything that important. And it's very much a team approach. You won't have one exam in this class that's not done as a team. You won't have one exam in this class in which you haven't seen the questions in advance. You won't have one exam in this class in which you don't work together as groups. It's part of the whole exercise of getting you to interact in very specific ways. And so we have a team approach. I'm part of the team. You're part of the team. Very interactive, very Socratic. And what that means is that I'm not going to answer any questions the entire quarter. You ask a question, which I hope you do, I'm going to ask you to call on someone else in the class to answer the question. And so we have this very Socratic method going back and forth in which we have an interactive and a collective in terms of everyone taking responsibility for their learning. And it is fun. Not grading, it's not testing, it's not being put on the spot, trying to have a little bit different kind of educational experience. Furthermore, we have this undergraduate seminar, and so when you go into discussion, it's not like, hey, I didn't understand this, or, you know, how do I solve this problem? It's really a seminar. And in fact, as part of that seminar will be in about 5 weeks, we're all going to get dressed up in costumes. We're all going to get a script, and we're all going to march up to the law school, and we got the moot court, and we're going to put on a trial right in that courtroom. We're going to have judges and juries and prosecutors and defense, and I'll have my robes on, and you guys will have that, and we're going to really do the trial of the century, which is a very different way of doing learning. And you're going to find this a lot of fun. And in fact, Jessica, it takes a lot of work to get this moot courtroom, doesn't it? Almost impossible, and I'll tell you some stories about that when we get there. But the point here is that we will talk about science a lot. I'm going to say that again. We're going to talk about science a lot. And why are we going to talk about science a lot? More than probably most of you even thought. Because once you understand the science, then you can understand what you think about the science much better. If you don't understand the science, you're sort of giving your opinions about what's happening on an unknown process. But if you understand the science, then your opinions have much more substance because then you understand the process. And by understanding the process, it formulates how you think, either for or against or neutral or whatever. But it affects your thought process as opposed to just talking about the unknown. So we'll talk a lot about science. We'll also talk about the implications of science and genetic engineering. And as I said, we'll have real-life situations. You will have some exams that you'll learn a little bit more about. But all of your exams, as I said, are group exams. You'll have one written exam, which is a take-home exam, and you'll have two other exams, which will be oral exams, group oral exams, which are pretty novel and a lot of fun, which we do it all collectively, but I'll talk more about that later. You'll have some projects. We'll do lots of experiments in class, like next week you'll actually do your own cloning experiment with bacteria right here in this class, and a couple weeks after that, you also be genetically fingerprinted. You're going to absolutely know exactly what some of your genes look like from the point of view of a DNA fingerprint. You'll have your own DNA fingerprint, which you've read so much about in the newspaper, and we'll do it right here in this class. That's how easy it is. And then more than that, I'm going to bring in some pretty spectacular people who are going to give you some real-life experiences. So we're going to have a very close friend of mine who's the CEO of a biotech company, and he's going to play entrepreneur with you, and you're going to find out what it's like to make a biotech company. We're going to have the head of the Los Angeles Crime Lab come down and talk to you about DNA testing in crime and cases and talk to you about some of the things that they do down at the LAPD. We're going to have an expert on genetically modified plants come in and talk to you about the pros and cons of that technology. We're going to have a wonderful individual talk about in vitro fertilization and pre-implantation genetic testing that you're going to learn about in this class. And we're going to have a futuristic thinker at the end of the class, Greg Stock, among others, talk about the implications of all this technology in the future. And those guys are going to tell you not only about their life experiences, how they got into what they got into, which I'll tell you a little bit about, but they're also going to bring this stuff alive in specific areas. And then you'll go to dinner with them when they're here and share some of the things. And if there's enough room, you might have some repeat dinners and stuff. So it's a very unique thing. I only threw this up as a graphic to show you that this is the fourth year that this program has been taught. It's actually, class has been taught longer than that by me, but I won't get into it. In some respects, 20 years ago, and it was 20 years ago, I originated this class in the Honors Collegium, and it was the first science class at UCLA, GE class for non-science majors. Of course, it's a very different class now, but we were pioneering then, and we're pioneering now, and all of you are still pioneers, which is what I love, because the idea is not to go with the groove, but to break the groove. And that's what we try and do here, to go against the mold. But the point here is you'll see that in these two classes, we've had, you know, close to, you know, plenty of students here. And you can also see that mainly non-science in a variety of different majors. The point here is that it's a very exciting experience for all of us. And more than that, I want you to know that I'm going to give you as much as I possibly can, and let's see if we get some agreement, probably the best experience that I can as a teacher, because I take this stuff pretty seriously. And so, do any of you have, before I let you go, and we'll pick all of this up on Thursday, any questions about anything? Don't be bashful. Don't be shy. The only thing I ask is speak into the microphone because we make little projects of this, and I like to get it all on tape. So remind me of your name again.
My name is Nikhil.
Okay, Nikhil. Got it? Try this one.
Batteries are probably out.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm Nikhil. My question was, we were talking about transferring genes from one organism to the other earlier. So let's say you have one specific gene. Will it work the same way in one organism and a different way in another?
Ask someone in the class. What's your question? So what's the question?
Well, the question is, will one gene work the same way in two different organisms?
Well, from just what you've had in this class today, let's just stick it to the very limited example of what you have, the very limited example of what we went over. What is your name?
Magias.
How would you answer that question? Why don't you take the microphone?
So the question is...
if you take a gene from one organism, will it work in another organism in the exact same way? Let's just take it from this one limited example I gave you today of the GLOW gene.
Well, if you take the GLOW gene, for example, and the plant, actually, it affected the whole plant. So
But it glowed. Glowed, right?
Uh-huh.
So what does that say about the function of that gene in the jellyfish relative to the plant?
That it functions the same way.
So what's the answer to your question for that gene and that gene alone? Because we can't extrapolate it beyond your experience. What would you say? Take the mic.
For that gene particularly, you'd probably say, yeah,
okay.
It would.
Now, what was an example I also gave you in which the gene was taken out of the jellyfish but made to work in specific parts of the mouse? So does that mean that the gene might do exactly the same thing in organism A as it does in B?
But in that case... Well, in that case, did you change the gene itself, or did you just target it to...
Let's say we changed the parts of the gene that targeted to different parts of the animal.
Well, in that case, it's doing different things.
Doing the same thing, but slightly different
differently,
ways.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
It's making the same protein that glows, but it's doing it in slightly different places. Well, the jellyfish doesn't have any paws or eyes or anything like that. So what's then the answer to your question using genetic engineering?
It's still a yeah, because, I mean...
What's the process that we learned about limited in the class about genes? Do they function universally between organisms in general?
No.
I can take the bacterial gene and put it in the human, and the human gene and put it in the bacteria, the jellyfish gene and put it in the mouse. Does that mean they function universally?
Yeah, I suppose. But would that only apply to the specific gene that we were talking about? Or?
Well, what about insulin, TPA? What about all these other proteins that we could do that with?
Mm-hmm. So then.
But you can alter it in specific ways by using genetic engineering. So there's no absolute to your answer, your
exactly.
question. Okay?
Yeah,
so the answer is yes, but maybe you can change it by using genetic engineering. But maybe in some cases it might be a no. But the no is pretty rare. Okay? There was another question someplace. Don't be bashful. Daisy. Be prepared to ask somebody else the question.
I just had a question about the reading.
Okay.
Which textbook are we supposed to read from?
What is it? Principles of Biotechnology? Introduction to Biotechnology. It's a little paperback, and you can buy it used in the bookstore. Okay, there it is right over there. Okay? Any other questions? More conceptual rather than procedural, or procedural if you have them. Is there one over here? There we go. What's your name? Just say who you are when you... Because everyone's going to have to know everyone, because on Thursday, you have pictures of everybody in the whole class. So, go ahead.
Okay, my name's Matt.
Okay, Matt.
And I had a question. Not sure if anyone can answer it or if you can address it a little bit, but about the no. Took LS2 last quarter, and in that, basically talked about you go from DNA transcribed into RNA, mm-hmm. translated into different proteins. Mm-hmm. Proteins can serve multiple mm-hmm. functions. Mm-hmm. That single gene can carry all mm-hmm. multiple functions, not any.
What's your question?
So my
that
question is,
speech.
Right.
I want a question.
Okay, so then the question is you put these genes into new organisms, and with this glowing and stuff, it seems to do the same thing in this organism as that organism. But is it possible that, say, we genetically engineer food in some way, and it does one function in this animal, but then, say, we have certain receptors on our the outside
just
of our
make
cells.
A simple question.
Basically, the simple question is...
I know there's some French majors in here and some international development majors, and they probably lost some of your terminology. So just what's the simple question?
I think just today we seem to say, like, there haven't really been any problems with genetic engineering, but I'm kind of curious about what are the chances that something could go wrong that's unforeseen and unexpected.
Okay. Who wants to answer that question? Anton? You want to answer that question?
I don't know what the answer is.
Well, what do you think? Take the microphone. So, really, can I rephrase your question, Matt? The question is, are there absolutes? That's what you're really saying. Is everything absolute?
Well, no.
Does it always, always, always happen this way? Okay? What do you think the answer to that is?
I don't think it always will happen a certain way, and I think it's possible that something really bad will happen.
Well,
but
let's not speak in terms of bad and good, because those are sort of, you know, culturally tainted words, you know,
okay.
as you can imagine. So something could cause that gene maybe not to function the way you predicted it to function.
Yes, in which case you had a bad prediction.
Well, not necessarily a bad prediction. That doesn't mean you have a bad prediction. You have a prediction based on your observations, but you didn't have all the observations. And when you did the experiment, you got a new observation, so you had to change your hypothesis. That's neither good nor bad. That's the scientific process. And so, to answer the question, what do you think, Matt? Answer your own question.
I guess, yeah, no, absolutely.
So, in order to answer that question, would you go on percentages in some way?
Would
you walk on the street every day?
Right. And like,
you take aspirin when you have a headache? Could there be any side effects? Is it possible that something could happen when you get in an airplane?
I think my basic point is yeah, all that can happen, so it's important to proceed with a certain level of caution.
So let's just say then, and we're going to talk a lot about this, that what would be the level of caution that you would be comfortable with? 30 years of experiments or 1 week of experiments?
Well, that's why I'm here, to try to figure that out.
What would you think? Is there a certain amount of risk to everything we do? It's like an AIDS patient. Would you rather have the vaccine or the drug that might not be thoroughly tested, but it might help you? Or do you want to wait 15 years until you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there'll be absolutely no side effects?
Right, you want to do it right away. I think, was it rhodopsin or they ran into
rhodopsin is a protein in the eye.
That's right, that's right.
So the point here is that there's risk versus benefit. And you have to weigh the two. And you take those risks every single time you put an aspirin in your mouth. Because aspirin causes intestinal bleeding if you take too many of them. And you can have all kinds of anemic effects by taking aspirin, but yet we all take them because they can help us in many ways. So we're going to get into these discussions, but again, it's risk versus benefit. And that's why knowing the scientific basis of all of these things and how they work and what has been done helps you assess what the risk is. First time someone drove a car on the street, there's a lot of risk. But now there might not be as much. Any other questions? Okay, what do we need to do, Jessica? Those of you who haven't had your pictures taken, please take your pictures. Who hasn't had your picture taken? Okay, so you hang out so we can get your pictures taken. How many of you haven't filled out your survey? Then I'm going to ask you one final question before you leave. So fill out your survey. Pick up your articles. And finally, no chickening out here. You know, no chickening out. You guys are in it for the duration. So just keep in mind that all of this stuff is going to be pretty simple and pretty exciting in a few weeks. So give it a shot. It's new and different. I'll see you on Thursday. Thank you.